You are listening to Friends of Europe's podcast. Don't miss our debates on global and European issues that span political, economic, social, and environmental challenges, and follow our website at friendsofeurope.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. Thank you for being here quite bright and early. My name is Shada Islam. I'm Director of Policy here at Friends of Europe, and I'm delighted that you're attending this conference. For the discussion is going to be about time for peace. So we'll be discussing the challenge of ending war and violence and conflict in Africa and the Middle East with some of the region's leading thinkers and their counterparts here in Europe. So, just a few words of introduction to this subject and why we decided at Friends of Europe to talk about it, obviously for very, very serious reasons. In our interconnected and interdependent world, developments in the Middle East and North Africa, the so-called MENA region, have a direct impact on Europe. And our policies, what we do here in Europe, also impacts on the people and the governments of that region. This strong connection is visible today in the form of the so-called refugee crisis facing Europe. War in Africa and the Middle East has meant increased terrorist activity on European soil as ISIS and Al-Qaeda spread their tentacles into Europe. So bringing peace and stability and prosperity to our southern neighborhood must be a European priority. That means promoting a number of things. It means promoting economic and political development through trade, investments, job creation, education, and skills development. There must also, and this is very, very vital, be more interaction with youth, civil society, and business representatives of the region. It's a vast and a very complex agenda, but I think, yes, we can. So this morning, we're going to talk about these and many other issues, and joining me for this first panel are some very important thinkers, policymakers from the region and from Europe. First of all, let me introduce very briefly Mr. Ali Zedini. He's a member of the National Dialogue Quartet that, as you know, won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2015. He's been working on human rights issues for a very, very long time. So thank you very much indeed, Mr. Zedini, for joining us here. Pleasure to have you. Also joining us from the region is Ahmed Galal. He's Managing Director of the Economic Research Forum and a former Egyptian finance minister. He's widely regarded as the leading expert on the economics of the Middle East and North Africa, and he's also worked at the World Bank. Also coming from Tunisia is Hella Grichy. She's a writer and student at the École Supérieure Normale in Tunis and is a young Arab voice identified by the Anna Lindh Foundation. Hella, thank you for coming. I think it's a break in your studies a little bit, but thank you for joining us here. Sergio Piccolo, advisor on the Southern European Neighborhood Policy at the European Commission. And soon to join us will be Adam Kuntu, president of UNITE, which is a very interesting new organization of new European business entrepreneurs of immigrant descent. So the rules of the game are very simple. I'm going to give the floor to Mr. Zedini for a bit, about 8 minutes or so. He's going to introduce the topic, and then I'm going to do a round of questions. Each panelist has about 5 minutes or so to answer, perhaps a second round, and then I'll open the floor to all of you because I see many friends here with great knowledge and expertise and experience of the region, and your interaction, your dialogue with us will be very important. So, Monsieur Ali Zedini, je vais vous laisser ma place.
Merci, Madame la Présidente.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good morning, everyone. I would like to express my warmest thanks to Friends of Europe for giving me the opportunity to talk to you and to share the Tunisian experience, as well as to make some remarks on the developments in that region and to point out the current challenges. You are all aware of the fact that everything started on December 17th in 2010 after a young Tunisian set fire to himself in a city far away from Tunis, in an underdeveloped city in a remote area of the country. So it all started with various claims of economic and social nature. After this, there was an uprise of the young people, and what was called the Arab Spring began. In Tunisia, it lasted for 1 month until January the 14th, when President Ben Ali fled the country. Ben Ali governed with a police state and not with a military state, as is the case in other Arab countries. Therefore, there was a big vacuum when he left, a vacuum in terms of security, which was filled by the civil society. It was precisely the role of the civil society that is quite interesting to present here. In fact, in Tunisia, we have a great experience of civil society filling the gap in the absence of security authorities. We don't have much time to discuss this, but I'm prepared to answer any question you might have in this respect. So thanks to the civil society, elections could take place in order to create a new constitution. So this assembly was mainly tasked with the drafting of a new constitution. But then the assembly was also tasked with to become a government of the country. The Ennahda Islamic movement came to power, and from the moment the constitution was drafted, a major political crisis began. This major political crisis came from the fact that Ennahda wanted to discuss identity issues, whereas the majority of Tunisian people wanted to discuss economic and social issues. So there was kind of a clash between Ennahda and the people. Some people were murdered. So at the end of the day, we were forced to resort once again to the civil society. And that's where the national dialogue started. This national dialogue was convened and monitored by four organizations: the General Trade Union, the Tunisian Human Rights League, the barristers, and the Business Entrepreneurs Association. And those four organizations monitored the national dialogue. There was a roadmap with a pretty ambitious agenda. And at the end of the day, we managed to lead three processes: the government process, the constitutional process, and the election process. So we managed to reach our objectives, and that's why we were awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. There are still many challenges ahead, many challenges. So we succeeded in managing a democratic transition process. We managed to set up sustainable institutions, elections free and democratic and transparent. The elections were organized and took place. Yet we couldn't provide an answer to those major issues which caused the uprising of the young people, namely the economic and social problems. The number one problem in Tunisia is an economic and social problem. So the major challenge is how to overcome these socio-economic problems and how to overcome young people's unemployment. Out of 11 million people, we have 800,000 young unemployed, 300,000 of which are graduated from university. So this is a major challenge. So we really need to provide answers to these questions. Next, there is a need to develop underdeveloped regions. There is a huge discrepancy between this, the seaside areas and the more landlocked areas. Many young people from those landlocked areas were recruited by the terrorist groups. So these are the major challenges we are faced with: the development of remote areas, underdeveloped areas, and second, to meet the expectations of the young population, of the young people. Another challenge is the fight against terrorism. We don't even speak about fighting terrorism. We say how to address terrorism, because we need to address it. We don't just need to fight and to combat terrorism, because combating has a security dimension only, and we see this as a multidimensional, multifaceted issue. The first dimension to address is to fight against exclusion and marginalization. Second, it requires to reform the educational system. It also means to foster culture and arts, as well as to provide youngsters with possibilities to have leisure time in those remote areas where people don't even have access to internet. Next, there is also the security dimension, of course. Another challenge under the same heading is our neighborhood with Libya. The situation in Libya, in other words, because as you know, in Libya there is a huge quantity of weapons and arms, and these weapons have a direct impact on the Tunisian people. Before the Arab Spring, no Tunisian would even know the meaning of Kalashnikov. They had never heard of this word. Personally, I heard of it sometimes here and there when I attended a conference abroad. But the Tunisian people, since they didn't have a military regime, had never heard about the names of the weapons. My grandmother now will ask me, "Do you have a Kalashnikov?" So just to portray the impact of weapons on Tunisia today. So the situation of Libya is a real issue and a real concern. Currently, the situation is quite difficult in Tunisia. Very difficult. But we managed to organize a democratic transition. But a democratic transition is not an economic and social transition. Currently, the situation in the region is much more difficult. Wherever I go, people ask me, why did it succeed in Tunisia and not elsewhere? Why? And this is a question that requires a lot of reflection. But this is a simple question in my view. It succeeded because there are some specificities. We have a strong civil society in Tunisia. We have a strong women's movement in Tunisia. When ENADA, during the drafting of the constitution, spoke of complementarity, that women were meant to complement men, whereas the draft constitution spoke of gender equality. This comment of ENADA caused an uprising in the population, and Article 2 of the constitution was imposed. Article 2 says that Tunisia is a civil state based on citizenship. Based on citizenship and the rule of law. And the people's legitimacy or something like that. So there is no reference whatsoever to God. It's really secular. And this Article 2 was imposed because we have a very strong civil society. We also impose Article 6 in the constitutions, which refers not just to the freedom of religion, but also the freedom of conscience. Freedom of conscience in a Muslim world. That is the reason why I'm saying you cannot have a top-down approach. You cannot say that whatever happened in Tunisia can be copy-pasted in Yemen or elsewhere. You have to take on board the specificity of each country. So in Tunisia, we also have a historical background. We have a historical background of diversity. We have all history. Yesterday, I told friends that in the 30s, one of our famous writer, Amar Haddad, who never, who only studied in Tunisia, who came out from Tunisian schools, wrote a book titled "Our Woman Within Sharia," and he advocated for gender equality. And this guy was not graduated from Harvard nor from Sorbonne in Paris. It was somebody who never left Tunisia. In 1881, we had a very advanced constitution. In 1861, 20 years before the French colonized the country. So we have our specificities, of course. And of course, there are many other problems in the region. The interference, major powers interfering with internal affairs. From time to time, you see kind of proxy wars. So there are some strategic or geostrategic problems at stake. This is the reason why we are faced with a very heterogeneous situation. So this was just an appetizer, if you like. Should you have questions, I will be very pleased to answer them. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much indeed, Mr. Zedini. You really nailed properly the questions we have to discuss today, and I think you've set the tone for our discussion. Thank you very much indeed for your very frank and honest appraisal of what's right and what's wrong in Tunisia today, and I think what you've said applies perhaps to the wider region as well. So I'm going to jump right into the issues you've talked about, which is basically, yes, there is hope and there is change that's happened, but there are major problems of social and economic development that remain unresolved, and without that you cannot guarantee the future of a nascent democracy like Tunisia. So I'm going to go to you, Ahmed Galal, and ask you immediately, you as an economist, do you think that this assessment is right, that it's all about jobs, employment, especially for young people, and that without that there will be no time for peace?
Can you hear me? Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Shella. Thank you, Europe's World, for inviting me. Is it all about jobs? That is the question. No, it is not. It is actually a complicated story. And I think if one wants to look forward and see how this region might make few steps forward and really develop, I think one has to understand the root causes of the problems, and then see how one can move forward. And to me, the root causes of the problem are three. One, bad politics, historically. Mr. Zedini talked to us a little bit about the Tunisian case, but I'm familiar with all the other cases, and I'll come back to that. It's bad politics, it's bad economics, and three, we have had more than our share of regional conflicts. Hmm. Let me go back and say a few words about each quickly. It's bad politics, and most people who think about the region have come to the conclusion that the relationship between leaders and their citizens in the region historically has been characterized by what people call the authoritarian bargain model. Basically, leaders promised their people or made a contract with their people, I give you some economic handouts, and you just go for don't ask for political rights. That is the name of the game. That is fundamentally why we have had an Arab Spring, whether it's in Tunisia or in Egypt or elsewhere. that is fundamentally, that contract, that authoritarian bargain collapsed at one point in time. Especially with liberalization, the role of the state has seen a decline. A very interesting statistics. The average public expenditure relative to GDP in the region in the 70s was something like 60% of GDP. With the liberalization in the 90s and afterwards, the size of public expenditure to GDP has declined to 30%. Think about the logic behind that. Basically, the government was providing fewer resources to health and education and infrastructure and roads and this and that, which means that the middle class was actually suffering. What they used to get under a previous form of the contract is no longer available. Basically, people were not happy with the regime. So that is the bad politics. Bad economics, we have all heard about the jobs is one part of the story. A lot of young people graduating from universities are not finding jobs. There is a mismatch between labor demand and labor supply and skill mismatch and so on and so forth. And there is a slow capacity to generate productive jobs in the private sector, formal private sector. There are a lot of informality in the region. So but that's not really what I mean by the bad economics, because the bad economics took also another turn that's related to politics, which had to do with a phenomenon we call crony capitalism. Many of the countries in the region, whether it's Tunisia or Egypt or other countries, were actually not doing too badly on economic growth. Average growth rates in the region were in the neighborhood of 5%, 5 plus. That's not so bad, actually. It's not as great as China, but it's not as bad as a lot of other countries. The trouble is that most of the benefits from the growth was going to those connected with the regime. So it's privileges, it is privileged access by those who are connected. I have a couple of studies, actually, very interesting ones but I can come back to that anyway. I can, elaborate a great deal about this crony capitalism concept because we have studied it, we have numbers for it, we know who is doing what to whom, not just by name, but as groups, as sectors, as the form these privileges have taken. Economics was not done in a way that benefits the population at large. It was conducted in a way to benefit the few. Now, the third part you all know about, which is the idea of the region has its more than its share of conflicts, and you see it pretty much everywhere, and it's proliferating, and there are no ends in sight in too many of them. Now, if you want to ask about development, for future development in the region, in my view, you absolutely have to deal with all three. You cannot do one little bit here and there, and things will be fine. That's not true. If conflicts are continuing, their flood of refugees will come to the EU, but at the same time, the people in the region are going to continue to suffer. And there is no, when you don't have security, you cannot even think about development. Forget about development. So that's number one. When it comes to economics, I happen to believe I invite you all to read a really wonderful book called Why Nations Fail. Mm-hmm. And the book is by Acemoglu and Robinson. And it basically is two economists, by the way, not political scientists. And the two economists argue that if you want to fix economics, worry about politics. Because, in fact, it is not the magic solutions that some economists come up with that does the trick. In fact, it is the politicians who decide to take on some economic advice and not other economic advice. So if you don't fix the politics and the political setup is such that it's serving the interests of the entire population, then forget about it. The regime will always figure out narrowly defined economic policies to serve themselves, to stay in power, and serve their own interest. I mean, I don't know whether I've given you an answer. But that's a start. We can argue a lot about whatever I said, but it's fine.
And we will, and you've set it out very well. I just have a quick question for you. You're absolutely right, I think, about politics being essential. But given the state of politics today in that region, there is little hope. Because you can talk economics all the time, but if the politicians are not taking the right decisions, as you've said, Ahmed, at the moment I don't see that happening anywhere in the region.
So You're asking me whether I'm hopeful or not, right?
Yep.
Well, I am. look, we
and
have
why
no,
are you hopeful?
Let me tell you, no, I don't give you an answer lightly. There are two states of the world. One of them is that you think that the world is going to collapse, and that's the end of a story, and you live miserably ever after. That's one state of affairs. The other one is to, even if the chance, anyway, the other state of affairs is that you are hopeful, even if you are only 10% right. That gives you keeps you going anyway. And moreover, at least it's a chance that you might succeed. But in any case, let me translate what I said into something that's a bit more tangible. And in fact, even talk about, since my friend Ali talked about Tunisia, let me just say a few words about Egypt, because I care about it. The institute I run is actually a Mediterranean institute. It's a regional institute. It's not focusing on Egypt as such, but I'm an Egyptian.
About Egypt.
Sorry?
We all care about Egypt.
Well, no, it's not true. I care about everybody, including you. I mean, No. More seriously, I think the idea of, is Egypt on the right track? Is Egypt going to make it at the end of the day? And I actually think yes. In my view, it's a question of when and how. Possible detours are likely. You might go back before you go forward. You might not always be making progress at all times. But I think fundamentally, both Tunisia and Egypt are moving in the right direction. I like to think about the region in three groups. Just let me step back for a minute. I like to think about countries like Jordan and Morocco. They are one category by themselves. They are the progressive, gradual reformers who are getting there, but slowly and so on. I like to think about Egypt and Tunisia, where dramatic changes are taking place, hopefully for moving in the right direction. And then I think I like to think about the conflict countries. And the conflict countries, you cannot talk about development in these countries. Syria, Yemen, Iraq, I mean, you really have, your first order of business is dealing with conflicts. Anything else, we'll have to wait for that. But going back to Egypt, I think the idea of Tunisia has made it, Egypt has not, is really an oversold idea. There is that distinction that is made in general about what is called de jure and de facto. Egypt, like Tunisia, we have our own constitution, and in fact, if you read the articles in the constitution in the Egyptian case, and we didn't copy the Tunisian one, if you read the articles, they are perfect. They are actually not worse than any of the constitutions in any developed country. Citizenship, freedoms, liberties of all kinds, guarantees of all kinds, social justice of all kinds. I mean, there is nothing that's left out. But there is one thing to have the constitution done and well. There is one thing to have a president that's freely elected. There is the idea of a parliament that's also freely elected. This is the formality of politics. But the reality is, on the ground, who is actually ruling? Who has the power? Who decides what happens? Did the old regime and its construction, the way I described it earlier, disappear altogether and now we're starting all over again? We need to remember that transition countries do take time to mature. We know that the average in the Eastern European cases was something like 12 years at least. We are just talking about 5 years on and say, well, for God, 5 years on and nothing has happened. Was true, untrue. It's too early. Wait another 10 years and then let's have another meeting here.
Okay. Thank you, Ahmed, for putting things in context. And yesterday we talked about transitions and we talked about Indonesia as well, and there as well about 10 years of tumultuous politics before stabilization. So thank you for putting things in context. Hela, I'm going to turn to you. And, you know, we've talked about youth unemployment. Ali talked about it, how important that is in terms of development, but also potential recruitment for terrorists. So I want to get your voice in here. Tell me a little bit about your opinion on the future of Tunisia, but also this whole issue of unemployment of women, of young men, and how that is impacting on not just the society, but also the economics, please.
Okay. Hello, good morning, everyone. Thank you for having me here. So what I want to point out to start with is the fact that it makes me really sad when I talk to my fellows and they tell me that they miss the old times. So, Mr. Galal, you were saying that it's important, that it's not that important to have jobs. But I'd like to disagree here, because if you don't have jobs and if you don't have the financial means to realize...
Yeah, no, it's okay, I know.
I didn't say that.
No, Ahmed didn't say that, but please go ahead.
Yes, and I mean, in a way, we need to focus on one thing first, which is jobs. And I mean, it's true, all three things go hand in hand, but what I wanted to say actually is that if you don't have jobs and you don't have the financial means, how are we going to realize all the things that Mr. Ali Zardini talked about, which is arts, which is getting people away from terrorism through showing them a whole other perspective? I mean, for example, I study in Tunis, which is the capital, and it's really, the atmosphere there is really light when if you compare it to my hometown, which is in the northwestern region, and it's called Tabarka. And whenever I go there, you can feel the depression. You really can. People just go to the cafes, they speak about football, and women can't really go to the beach and on their own and have fun and go, I don't know, have normal times that we all know about as teenagers and young people. So we should have this... we should have a focus on employment to give people a chance to get out of their routine. So three things I want to talk about concerning youth unemployment is first, what really, really saddens me is when I come to Brussels or when I go to Paris or Germany or whatever, it's so nice to see that all you people are young. There's a mixture. There are older people with experience and there are young people with talents and who are competent and who can fight their way through. But if you go to Tunisia, you will always see that the majority of the places and spots occupied are older people, and it's like they fight their way through or are more trusted, and it's all at the expense of younger people who don't find a chance and don't find a place among the older ones. Also, people are afraid of the private sector, and this is a problem because it's a focus on security. People want to work with the government, people want to feel safe. But this discourages people from starting their own startups. They are afraid of entrepreneurship, and they just don't risk it, because why would they risk their whole fortunes or get credits, and then in the end they fail and will find themselves unemployed and miserable. Also, when it comes to critical positions in the government, we have the same problem. We also need more youth being integrated into critical decision-making positions. It's important to hear the voice of people who live in a generation that is different from those who are now taking decisions, because older people might listen to them. They might have conferences with them. It might be all well and formal, but on the ground, who is the one suffering here? If they're 20 and they don't have a job and they can't have a normal life. So this is what I wanted to say about unemployment. About my vision for the future, it's very subjective, of course, but I have mixed feelings about this. I think we are heading into the right direction, because a transitional process into a democratic system, and I say a democratic system, not a Muslim democratic system, it's a process. It takes time, naturally. I mean, Confucius, the philosopher, the Chinese philosopher, says a journey of 1,000 steps starts with the first one. So people who say they are impatient and that Tunisia is going downhill and that they are afraid, all we have to fear is fear itself. It takes time to get to something. I mean, even the French Revolution, even the American Revolution, everything, it was built one by one. So what we need is patience, we need hard work, and we need to go to the grassroots problems. Because in Tunisia, we can speak of laws and we can have nice conferences and talk about how we want to change. But if we look at the on-ground problems, if we look at those people who live in, I don't know, they don't even have homes, and they have like seven children, and they still believe that God will give these children their fortune. We have to change the mentality and tell people, no, God will not give your children free stuff. You just have to take birth control, have two children, raise them up to be better. And we were talking about this in the conference yesterday about Muslim Democrats and everything, and I said that I disagree with this appellation, because why would we have Muslim Democrats, Buddhist Democrats, homosexual Democrats, whatever Democrats? It's just democracy. It's just all this diversity in one room, all this diversity in one nation, and we just keep on fighting together and have this roof all over us. There should be no label. There should be no constraints by any scripture or everything. It's secularism, and we have to work on this mindset on integrating it.
Thank you. Thank you, Hera. That's very inspiring. And it's true that, you know, you can talk endlessly about Muslim democracies or not, but some people do want to have that appellation. So I think that's important to note. God will not create jobs in Tunisia. God's not going to do it. People have to do it. Are young people in Tunisia entrepreneurial? Are they willing to take risks to create their own SMEs or small? Where are the jobs going to come from? It's not going to come from the public sector as it has been in the past, right? So where do you look for jobs?
I think it's a mixture. It should be the normal system with the governmental jobs and everything. But also, as Mr. Ali Zadini said, the civil society are working on entrepreneurship and especially social entrepreneurship. And there's a young leader that I know. Her name is Ahlam Nasrawi. And she recently won a prize for her leadership. Because this young woman works very hard in civil society on sensitizing young people to actually take the risk. So what I'm saying is that it's true, people look for security and want governmental jobs, but we also need to create these little startups and opportunities.
Yeah. I'm going to ask Adnan about this in a minute, but I'm going to turn first. Thank you very much, Hela. I'll turn to Sergio. Sergio, the European Union has had long-standing relations with countries in the MENA region. Billions, I think, of euros have been spent in the region. Projects, bridges, budgetary support, all kinds of things. But there seems to be this prevailing sense of disappointment. It didn't work, didn't go right. What do you feel when you hear all these very real problems that the region is facing despite Europe's engagement for years and years?
How many days do you give me to reply?
You have 5 minutes.
1 minute. Now, it's very challenging to take the floor after this extremely stimulating interlocutors and friends here. So I said many days because your question is extremely challenging because it depends where you come from and from which point of view. From the point of view of the countries, from the point of view of the European citizens, of our taxpayers. So you may have a multidimensional approach to this question. I think that the most important thing to say is that you cannot create wonders in 1 second. Unfortunately, when we talk about education, vocational training, skills development, business startup, access to credits, liberalization of banking system, insurance, and so on and so forth, it takes time. The first time the European Union talked about the single market was in the, I think it was in the summit of 84 or 85 in Milano. It took something like 30 years to complete the single market. We have 4 freedoms: service, finance, goods, and persons, being free to circulate in Europe within the Schengen, so discuss Schengen context. This is the model we choose. We cannot impose anything to anybody, but we are looking each and every minute of our daily work to have a discussion with you guys from the civil society or with politicians on the other side, and this will not stop. The only thing is that we will discuss also with all interlocutors. We are not the only one. The European Union is not the only one actor. Of course, we are the elephant in the room because we are the biggest donors in the region. We are a political actor. All these friends and countries are in front of us. Now, I don't want to go immediately now in the migration things, but we spend something like 1 billion euros each and every year. Why we do not achieve what you are referring to? Because unfortunately, the mantra of this discussion is democratic legitimacy, is gender equality, is respect to human rights. It's not rhetorics. It's just because if you have democratic legitimacy in a country, you may have longer perspective for a government to intervene. You may have more business being friends of the, or not, of a politics of a government. This is the chain of democratic legitimacy. I mean, if you don't have this, how you can reach the trust of your domestic interlocutors, which is civil society, which is business, which is investors, and so on and so forth? Keynes said, we have to save, we have to invest, we have to spend. So these three criteria, if you don't have democratic legitimacy, do not work. How many seconds do we have? Fine.
I'm just going to stop you for a second. Democratic legitimacy. But we, Europeans, if I may use the word, were in bed with some of the worst dictatorships in the region. We were working with them, right?
Do you want to be friends of the people of these countries, or you want to be friends of the leaderships? I think that sometimes you must be a little bit cynical and be friends of whoever is represented politically a country in order to reach the civil society, in order to reach the people. I spent so many missions in Tunisia or in Egypt, even at the time of Mr. Ben Ali. My purpose, you refer to budget support, my purpose was to negotiate huge budget support to the European Union and setting criteria to be filled in order to spend different tranches of our budget support, regardless whether Ben Ali or whoever was on the power. And let me spend one single thing about what you said. I think the difference between Tunisia, for instance, and other countries, that Tunisia has a middle class. So some of the advantages, relative advantages of Tunisia nowadays, may refer to the reforms of Mr. Bourguiba. You may like it or not, but this is a fact. You have women, women have the right to vote in Tunisia since the 50s. Oh, correct me if I'm wrong. You have a middle class in Tunisia. You don't have this middle class in Algeria. You don't have a similar middle class in Morocco. You don't have it in Syria. Now Syria is a difficult case, of course. You don't have it even in Jordan. And you may speak about Egypt. Middle class is the la couche, which may give you the basic of the consensus and go for the three functions of Keynes, which I said before. Did I reply to your question?
You did, but can you tell me if the European Union has learned lessons from what went wrong as part of your neighborhood policy? What are you going to do right this time?
Sure. Let me just make a very flash reference to what happens after 2004. In 2004, we had this big enlargement, 10 countries, after the different previous enlargement. It was an extremely tough challenge to absorb that 10 countries. You refer to 12 years average of this country to reach the level of democratic legitimacy, economic development, and so on, of the previous member states. So it was a huge thing. The problem is that these 12 years were with countries which had before a democratic legitimacy and a parliamentary function. So it was a little bit easier, if you want, with
Eastern Europe.
With Eastern Europe, yes.
Democratic?
Well, before the war. The
opposite of democratic.
No, no. I mean, before the war, before the Soviet entract, they were a parliamentary democracy. So it was a little bit easier to come back to their criteria, to involve them in the European Union. Now, this is to say that after that enlargement, we decide to have a policy with the neighbors of the European Union, in the East and in the South. What went wrong? Two things. The first is that we apply the same criteria for Eastern and for the South, which are completely different animals. The second thing is that in 2010-11, fortunately, we had this Arab Spring, so we had to adjust our policy to this new issue. And we adopted the so-called more for more approach for our investment, our support. It did not go fantastically well. So we changed again in 2015 because we have the Syrian crisis, and crisis may explode each and every day. So therefore, a new approach. The mantra was stability in 2004. Now is stabilization, which is a completely different issue. Before it was one solution fits all, from Belarus to Morocco. Now is differentiation, tailor-made approach. If the countries want to do so, one example is that we are negotiating deep and comprehensive free trade agreements, not with all, because some of the partners are telling us we don't want this DCFTA. Some of them, they do want. Egypt does not want. Tunisia wants. Okay, let's go for a different approach. And then ownership. You need to have an understanding of something if you want to go ahead or you want to reach an objective. If you do not share basic values I referred before, which are always the same, the rule of law, respect of human rights, democratic legitimacy, if you do not share these values, you go nowhere.
Okay, so hope for the future there. Adam Kumchu, I wanted to ask you, because all of us, all of our panelists have talked about jobs, and your organization, your members are working quite closely with the region because there are many diaspora entrepreneurs. What do you see as the main challenges that your members face when they are trying to set up jobs, businesses, invest, trade with the MENA region?
Shada, thank you for the invitation. I'm representing quite an interesting organization. It's unique in Brussels because we represent 15,000 entrepreneurs and business professionals of immigrant background. We call them new Europeans because after 50 years of presence in Europe, I think we are Europeans, not because of our blood, but because of the values, of the European values we are there. Not only democracy, accountability, transparency, rule of law are very, very important in my view. But these 15,000 entrepreneurs and business professionals, 90% of them are of Turkish descent, to be honest. Only 10% are from Morocco, Tunisia, Lebanon also. But even with this 10%, we have a good idea of the barriers they are confronted in investing in their country, trading with their country. In general, we see in our surveys that our members want to help and remain engaged with their countries of origin. Their hearts are still there. They want to do something. But when you see their experience, I'm not very happy with it, and they are not happy with it also. In terms of remittances, money they are sending to their country of origin, especially for the diaspora in the MENA region, we are talking about $53 billion in 2014. These are real statistics. But when they want to invest and trade, they fear what they call the lack of transparency, the opacity of rules, corruption, nepotism, clientelism, and I'm just citing a number of the things they are telling us. Weak legal framework, lack of supportive networks, but especially lack of trust in governments, institutions, bureaucrats, and business partners. They see themselves here in Europe as strangers. They see themselves also in their country of origin as strangers. But even worse, they experience a kind of thing like people there see them as very rich people, and they are confronted with opportunistic behavior from each part of the population. I think if we want to stimulate the relations between the European Union and the MENA region, the example of EU-Turkey relation is an interesting one. Not that Turkey will become ever a member, a full member of the European Union. I still have dreams, but I'm a realist at the same time. But I think the process of becoming a member of the European Union is still a very interesting process for democratization. Is it a success today? Everybody knows what's happening now in Turkey. Autocratism is back. Unfortunately, I think a democratic sensibility of the population is not enough. You also need the power to access this democratic rule in your country. If there is not nepotism, if there is clientelism, if there is a kind of power circle around people at the power, you may want to be very democratic, but you can't. You are submitted to this power, unfortunately. What can be the role of the diaspora abroad very positive in general, because we have experience since I live in Europe since 42 years. I know what it is to live in a democracy, even if I'm discriminated still after 40 years of presence in Europe. But I know to appreciate this. By my relations in Turkey, we are able to engage civil society in Turkey to fight against any kind of authoritarianism. And I think diaspora may play a role not only for the prosperity in the region, but also for peace in the region, but also at the same time for democracy in the region. But it's a long term, and it's not an easy one. It's chicken or egg problem. I need power to have democracy, but if I don't have democracy, I do not have the power.
Thank you very much, Aden. You've made some very, very, very good points. First of all, back to the issue of crony capitalism that Ahmed brought up earlier, but also the need for reform and how diasporas connecting with home origin countries do bring about change in attitudes and approaches as well. And the fact that, in fact, that's what membership or lack of membership of the EU can do, because one of the things you talked about was the enlargement, and that generated reform in the countries. They had to meet certain standards. So thank you very much indeed for those very valid comments. Thank you all. I'm going to open the floor now, because we've been talking for some time and we've made some, I think, very valid points that need to be discussed with yourselves. So please, we have several roving microphones in the room. Please put up your hands. I would make a plea for short interventions, because that way we can have a real interactive discussion. So please, can I have a show of hands of people who will be asking questions? Okay, Fabio, there's the gentleman right there next to you at the back. At the back, Fabio. Then come forward there, yeah. There, just put up your hand again, please. Thank you.
Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity. I've got about two contributions to make. One is that I think corruption is draining the fiscus of Africa. It has become now more of a cancerous issue, which I think the policymakers need to address it in a very sober and professional manner. I can give you an example. For example, within Zimbabwe, about a month ago, the president acknowledged having lost 15 billion from the fiscus through corruption, and up to now, no commission of inquiry has been set up, and no arrests have been made, and things like that don't do good to Africa. The second one, I think, is trade barriers. Africa is not sincere about its own policies within trade. At the moment, 12% annually is the economic trade within African member states only. And these statistics are as of 2014. And 88% of their trade is externalized. Yet Africa has got a population of 1.03 billion people. And I think, why is it that Africa doesn't trust itself in member states trading? So policymakers here, maybe they can shed light to that. Thank you.
Thank you. Very good points, especially about regional integration and corruption as well. The gentleman over here, please, Fabio. I've seen your hands at the back. I have.
Good morning. Aris Kokinos from Eurobol.com. A question for His Excellency Ahmed Galal. You have spoken about the common points in the MENA region between Egypt and other countries. But seen from abroad, of course, we know the weaknesses of Egypt. We also know some of its strengths. It has the Canal Suez, the Suez Canal. It has the Nile, and it probably has a big gas field, the Zohra field. In your opinion of Finance Minister, how could this field, if proven, could be used to get a virtuous circle for all the population and for the entrepreneurs there?
Thank you very much. I will ask the panel now to respond to these two questions. Ali, would you like to kick off with the issue of perhaps corruption, which probably is one of the, your struggles as well? I'll come back to the other questions in a second.
Oui.
Yes, I think you're right. The main challenge in the region is actually to fight corruption. And it is high on our agenda, at the, on the agenda at least of the civil society, because the problem was raised. And the problem was even raised within the constitution. We do have constitutional bodies, and one of them is named the Independent Body for Good Governance and the Fight Against Corruption. This particular body is not active yet. We decided to have five of them, and four of them are already active. We have one devoted, for example, to sustainable development, etc. But the last one to be set up, the last body to be set up, is the body related to corruption. And the civil society is really worried by that particular situation, because for the time being, we have a series of statements which have been made on a daily basis regarding the corruption problem. The president of that particular body or institution did refer to a situation which created some buzz in Tunisia. He did refer to the fact that the municipal police decided to sell meat which was not good to be eaten to students. So the fight against corruption is actually a genuine problem in our country, and it does hinder development, because with corruption, it is impossible to talk about investment. It is impossible to talk about development. It is impossible to talk about future investments. So the issue is of the utmost importance for us, and we need to have a close look at it.
That has been asked. I'll come to you in a second, Ahmed.
This is again a crucial issue. I mean, you said that this poor figure of 12%, if I understand you correctly, 12% of intra-Africa trade, which is absolutely nothing. So are they shy or what? I mean, in the southern Mediterranean region is just 5% of inter-regional trade. So these figures show that there is a big problem, because of course, this may be an engine of job creation and welfare, this kind of regional trade. You are also very well placed to tell us why. What I can see is that, of course, if you want to have a trade exchange with your neighbor, you have to trust the institution and the environment of your neighbor. Is there any transparency and accountability in financial management, as you said before? Are people legitimate as interlocutors in terms of business investment? Are the essential requirements set, a transparent banking system, a legislation on investment which is conducive to attract domestic, international investment, and so on? So these are basic questions which, again, the European experience have addressed in the last 30 or 40 years, which required huge reforms in the sense of the terms that I said before. So, I mean, of course, in the case of the sub-Saharan Africa and in the southern EMP region, we are trying to help with different support in different contexts, the Agadir process, the Luxembourg process, the EMP policy, and in all these contexts, we're trying to help in supporting this transition. But again, if you don't have a transparent, accountable system in the country, it's difficult to attract investments. Mm.
Thank you. But Ahmed, in addition to the question asked by my colleague here, transparency, trust, right, but it's also about connectivity, right? How do you get regional integration if there are no regional connections? It's on.
Let me actually make three comments. One on regional integration and link it to the Egypt story. And I want to say something about, you know, prospects of Egypt and the gas, the natural gas discovery that you pointed out. And finally, I want to say something about corruption. On the regional integration, 15 years ago, together with a friend of mine, Bernard Hockman, we wrote a book, edited a book, called Arab Economic Integration Between Hope and Reality, and it turned out to be more hope than reality. Now, why? The more interesting question is not whether it turned out to be the case that way or not. The more interesting question is why. And it turned out that it's basically economics and politics. On the economics, the structure of production in the Arab countries is very similar. They more or less produce similar things, and they don't have differentiated taste big enough to allow for intra-industry trade. So basically, I'm selling you what I have, and you're selling me what you have, and we do free trade agreements in which we say, you sell me everything you don't have, and I buy from you everything that I don't want from you. Sort of attitude. In any case, the economics of trade for the region is not encouraging to intra-regional trade. That's one. Two, the politics, whenever you do regional integration of the EU variety or less than the EU variety, countries surrender part of their sovereignty. Rulers are willing to let somebody else decide for them a little bit here and there. The rulers in the region were not willing to do that. When you have these two factors, in addition to a third one, which is we don't have the EC or the EU institutional arrangements, you have all three reasons as to why regional integration it did not take place. And that remains to be the case today. So it is not just about barriers here and there. It is actually about something more fundamental. And if you really want to encourage free trade agreements, you want to worry about the economics of it, the politics of it, the institutional arrangements. I remember having a meeting with Amr Moussa when he became the director of the general director of the Arab League. He said, what do you think we should do in the region on the economics? I told him, don't do anything you have done in the past and do something new. And then when he asked me what is new that I can do, I told him, do liberal mobility agreements. Because the fact of the matter, even though the MENA region is not well integrated in terms of goods and services, they are incredibly well integrated as far as labor mobility is concerned, without governments doing anything about it. I mean, Egypt alone has 3 million people in the neighboring countries. So that's a lot of people. And that is happening without anyone doing anything about it. The EU has nothing to do with it, and the governments in the region also have nothing to do with it. So you need to think beyond it. Now, let me say one other related point to the regional trade agreements, or the regional integration in general, because I have written a paper a think piece or a small paper in the Europe's World called Rethinking the EU Policy Toward the Mediterranean Countries, in which I disagree with my friend here, basically, that whatever they have done so far is too little and too late. And the point is this. The point that was made earlier, that the promise of Turkey joining the EU did magic to Turkey. It's actually true. You don't have to have the agreement, but the promise of an agreement gets you to act as if you are getting the agreement. Using the agreement as an anchor for reform is more important than the agreement itself. So that's not. The EU's offer to countries in the southern Mediterranean countries was never attractive enough to entice them to do internal reforms, whether Bin Ali or now the new president. They actually don't have. The most they are offering right now is a deep free trade agreement. I'm sorry, you should have been offering deep free trade agreement long time ago when you started the association agreement in the first place. And in any case, that's not likely to be good enough. There is a need for searching for a new formula. If you don't mind, I would like to say something about corruption, or you
I
want
think
to...
we'll come back to corruption because okay. I want the others to all come right. in. But there was a question from my colleague that you didn't answer, Ahmed. I just very quickly do answer him about the virtuous circle.
I mean, the answer to your question is actually, my understanding of the question is that now with the discovery of this big natural gas oil field, I mean, Egypt now is going to be richer. That's not true. I happen to believe that
there is in the literature something called the natural resource curse.
Yeah.
Look at Venezuela.
Yes.
What's happening? Lots of oil. Venezuela is not doing very well compared with other countries that are not do not have such natural resources. Obviously, having discoveries of that kind is a good thing for the country because it makes more resources available for projects, for investment, for this, for that. But on the other hand, it might make you lazy. So I think the trick is to make sure that you are using the resources that were given to you intelligently and wisely. So I'm not guessing it. But let me, having said that, Egypt is a large economy, 90 million people. It's a really diversified economy. It's not a one commodity-based economy. It's a country that has enormous potential if you unleash it the right way.
Thank you for that. Let's take a few more questions. I have hands going up there. Very good. So could you, Khalid, start with the hand there and then move to Mohamed, and then we'll take it from there. Yeah.
Merci beaucoup. Je vais m'exprimer en français.
Thank you very much. I will speak French too.
Very briefly?
Yes, yeah, sorry.
Ariane Meunier, I will speak on my own behalf. My question is about the relationship with the diaspora. The diaspora is an opportunity, is a very positive element. But from the government's perspective, diaspora is not something that is easily manageable because there are also people who oppose the regime amongst the diaspora, people who fight for freedoms. My question, therefore, is the following, and I would like to have the views of the panelists on this. My question is, how could we find a good way to work with that diaspora, amongst which we find many young people, but also older people who have a memory of the history, which is important for the roots, and how can we use that diaspora to sort out the various fights and conflicts?
I really need brief questions
very
now.
Briefly, thank you very much. My question is to Mr. Jalal and to Mr. Piccolo. Vous avez parlé de la classe moyenne.
You spoke about the middle class that exists in Tunisia and not in other Arab countries, or to a lesser extent. I think that 20 years ago there was a middle class in all Arabic countries, but due to the privatization of companies in the Arabic countries that was imposed by the European Union, the situation has developed in such a way that this middle class has disappeared nowadays. Mr. Piccolo, I see a contradiction in your narrative because you ask third countries to respect the rule of law, democracy, gender equality, and that kind of things. Yet, when you are told that you have relationships with the dictatorship, the question is, should you have a friendly relationship with the government or with the people? What is your question? Well, the question is, should EU be clearer as to the relationships with the third countries and not use human rights as an excuse for not providing aid to those countries? I give the example for Tunisia, where tourism is in an appalling situation.
Interesting questions. Could you please go to the ambassador? Could you put up your hand, please? Khalid, the gentleman over here. Khalid, turn around. Ambassador, could you just stand up, please? Yes, yeah, thank you, Fabio. Yeah.
Thank you. John Murray, I used to be a South African diplomat. These days I'm a consultant on public affairs based in South Africa. I find the discussion extremely interesting this morning. To be brief, I think what the speaker said is very important, that there, by nature, there are not many factors promoting a regional integrated economy across North Africa and then again into the Levant. However, there has to be a vision, and I think this is what was said earlier. Who sets the vision? We've heard about perhaps a vision for labor mobility, but there has to be a vision for some kind of integration in the North African region. Who sets that vision given the situation? Should it come from the Northern African countries themselves? And what is the role of the EU in the MEDA process to help set that vision and create a platform for it to go forward? Thank you.
Thank you. The vision question, I had a hand go up. But I would like to, just there. Khalif, yes.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Nesbet Samasu. I'm the Chargé d'Affaires of Zimbabwe. I want to just make two contributions. The first one on job creation in support of what has already been said. I think that it is an area that requires a lot of focus. And I believe that in Africa, as we all know, the continent has got a lot of raw materials, and yet the country has continued to export those raw materials instead of beneficiation and value addition. I think that is a very critical factor that should be looked at, and I believe that the EU, in its partnership with Africa, should be able to support policy initiatives towards value addition and beneficiation that will create employment for the youth. My second point relates to corruption. Indeed, it is a big problem, and since my country has been mentioned, I would like to just assure the audience that the country is doing its best to fight corruption. We do have an anti-corruption commission and a comprehensive economic reform package which we are working with the World Bank and the IMF, of which issues of economic governance are part of that comprehensive exercise. Indeed, of course, the
Thank
President
you.
Mentioned...
Sir, I have to interrupt you. I do want the panelists to come in. And your points have been made very clearly. I would appreciate it if we continue now. Thank you very much indeed. So let's get to the panel. I don't see any other questions. Let's start with you, Aden, because the question of the diaspora from the lady there, I think, needs to be addressed.
La question de la diaspora est en effet...
The issue of diaspora is a matter of image, you know, because most of the time those people involved in the diaspora had to escape the country for political reasons as well. But it is true that diaspora is not really valued in Europe or valued as it should be. Just to give you an example, because Turkish migrants in Europe, 5 million Europeans of Turkish origin, 160 entrepreneurs, 60 billion of turnover, 1 million jobs created, 36% of them graduated from university. But what is the the number of policymakers who are aware of those figures and really want to value this human capital or these human resources, because it is important not only for Europe, but it is also important because they have an opportunity to create a bridge, you know, between their country of origin and the country where they live, i.e. here. They have the financial resources, but also have the communication means, the intercultural means to communicate about that. And it is something of the utmost importance if we really want to create a bridge between Europe and these countries.
Migration has been brought in. Is that something that your members also worry about, or are they just focusing on their country of birth?
To be honest, the question of regional integration is not an easy one, because your geostrategic position define your opportunities or not. If you are a country in the Middle East, your chance to get peace, it will not be the same if you are at the center of Africa, just to give an example. The second reason is that our members would like such an integration, but who can initiate such an integration? What will be the incentives indeed to stimulate such an integration? There are already historical conflicts in this region. Again, realism is important, but I think the European example may be an example, but there is a need to give the know-how to these countries. And will the European Union be motivated to do this? I think the question is there.
Yeah, we're going to turn to Sergio in a second. Hella, I would like you to come in on the different issues. It seems that we're talking a lot about middle class, corruption, regional integration. Are any of these issues that you feel comfortable with, that you feel are important for your region, or are we totally outside your priorities as a young woman from Tunisia?
Sorry, I didn't really hear you.
No, I said we've talked about a number of things that the audience and the panelists think are important. The middle class, corruption, regional integration, diasporas, etc. Are these things that are on your list of priorities also as a young Tunisian woman or not?
I think the issues raised are all very important, but I guess depending on each context and each country's specificity, the focus is different. So for example, if we talk about diaspora, it would be more urgent in Turkey's case or Egypt. But in Tunisia, maybe it's different. We have less entrepreneurs. The problem is I don't have statistics. Maybe you do have about Tunisian entrepreneurs, any statistics, but that for later. But what I wanted to point out, I like the question about the diaspora. And I noticed that maybe there's a problem of integration. And this problem of integration also depends on the media and the role they play in the world. Because I sense that there is a lack of sensitization of journalists and reporters. And it's easy to jump into stereotypes and point at certain things. And then other people will be at a disadvantage due to these stereotypes. So maybe it's important to implement more projects and programs concerning this, create a platform with mixed participants, let people know each other more. And there have been initiatives like this in Germany, where Germans invite Syrians or even other immigrants, right. Yeah. And they talk about the problems. They really address them. And there's been this experiment also where they come face to face with strangers, and in 4 minutes, these people feel comfortable talking with each other.
Right. So, thank you for that. But when you look at your country today and the priorities that you, and very briefly as a young woman, want, it is about employment. It is about jobs.
Yes, I stress that it's employment and social issues.
Social issues. Social issues such as continuing emancipation of women, is that a concern?
Emancipation of women and the elimination of narrow mindsets, of this limiting of freedoms. Because we have the laws, we have everything set, but on ground action and sensitization, this is what we need.
So fragilities, to deal with these fragilities.
Opportunities and change how people perceive each other.
Okay, thank you very much. Sergio, I'll go to you, Ahmed, afterwards, but I want to hear Sergio first. The questions that were addressed to you, and I'll come to you last. Please.
Yes, there are several things to be said. I think that there was a question about this middle class and the democratic rule in the country. And thank you for this question. I don't think that the middle class, if it existed in some of these countries, was destroyed or obstacled or impeded by any imposition by the European Union. What we are trying to say since years is that we need liberalizations of markets. We need transparency. We need accountability in the different sectors. We do not say privatization as such. Of course, this is a domestic decision to privatize or not. Sometimes this is not the best solution to be done. The second issue that you raise is that we support the elite or we support the people. We are in contradiction. I think this is a crucial issue and try to explain a little bit better myself. I think it was said this morning as well that we are all in agreement that you need better education, you need better technical vocational training systems, you need business to be supported, you need business services and so on. These things are conducive to economic growth, investment, job creation and welfare, regardless what is the elite. And tell me if I'm wrong. So, I mean, I remember having supported with budget support in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Algeria, in Morocco, in Syria, in Jordan, big budget support to foster education and technical vocational training systems. I didn't even know what the minister was at that time, because we still think, and we thought at the time, that these are crucial to be supported, to be improved, if you want to have job creation and employment. I think there was an issue on vision.
I want you to talk about your vision.
You want me to?
Yes, I do.
Well, I spent my last 5 years in Palestine, and I may talk hours on that experience. I was head of cooperation for the European Union, so I managed something like 350 million euros each and every year for doing different things. The first was to support salaries of the Palestinian Authority. I think in that context, which is a huge problem, you need someone with vision, both sides. You need a Mandela, you need a Gandhi, you need people like that, which are really one-off in the story, because you have to overcome what has been said in the last 70 years. This is my point on vision. Vision is also politics. Vision is also policy. So you need to be forward-looking if you want to achieve something. One day I had a director in the European Commission. I was very young, and this guy told me, if you need where you want to go, you go much faster to your objective. So this is the point on vision I wanted to make. I give you back the floor.
Thank you very much. Ahmed, please.
What would you like me to say?
Well, comment on the comments.
The comments are very rich. They are very big. You can just talk for the rest of the day, and that's not possible. So let me pick and choose.
Corruption. You said you wanted to talk about corruption, so I'm giving you the opportunity.
But I changed my mind all the time. That was earlier, right?
As long as you're brief, go ahead.
Now,
pour your heart out.
The point I want to make about corruption is a bit different from what has been said so far. There are two types of corruption. There's a corruption when someone gets a favor that they are not supposed to get. And that is when you get your commission, that's when you get your police, when you get your investigative, whatever, reporters. This is when you moralize and tell people it's the right thing and not the right thing. That's one type of corruption. And trust me, this is not the most serious source of corruption in my mind. The worst form of corruption is the one that is a legalized corruption. Many of the deals that were being made in either Tunisia or Egypt and other countries in the region, or maybe in fact somewhere else, are legalized corruption. That is, when the rules are done in such a way as to favor the people you want to favor in the first place. In our fight to reduce corruption, I think we get too much carried away in the direction of the criminal type of corruption and too little in the direction of removing the room for what we call rent-seeking activities. Whenever I prevent the import of one commodity, for instance, and I give a license to someone, to my friend, he is the one who is going to get rich. It's a legal thing. I gave him the right to do so. When I distribute land in such a way that I benefit someone, when I give information ahead of time to a friend of mine so that they can get access to land or a loan in a bank. I want to make sure, that is why I want to link that point to the other point that I have been making consistently throughout, which is politics is really the root of the problem, because when politicians are not accountable, this is what they do. They tailor the rules in favor of their friends. And that's when you get bad business environment. This is when you get lack of transparency and the rest of it. May I say something else, or you look like you're going to run away?
No, I'm not going to run away. I'll give you 30 seconds to say something and then give the floor to Ali. Go ahead.
Well, thank you very much. That's my 30 seconds.
Thank you.
I was going to say something about regional integration and role of EU, but I think it's...
But you can.
I think on regional integration, let's not lose sight of what we are trying to do. I think we really should go back to basics. And basics are what? What did the people in Tunisia or Egypt or elsewhere went out asking for? It is bread, which is economic prosperity, essentially. It's freedom, which is democracy. Liberal democracy, by the way, not just democracy. And what's the other one? Dignity or something, right? Social justice. Social justice.
Well, rule of law is part of the dignity. But anyway, social justice, prosperity, and freedom, that's really what this is all about. I want to ask myself, in which way would regional integration help me achieve these objectives, right? I mean, that is really the question. That's how it works in my head. And I think regional integration is not an ultimate destination in its own right. I want to use regional integration, whether within the region or the support from the EU to the region, to achieve these objectives. And that brings me back to one more comment that was made by someone in the audience. Whom is the EU dealing with? You are dealing with, historically at least, you have been dealing with autocrats, or people who actually were benefiting themselves and those around them. So do you listen to these, because that's the formal channel that you have to deal with, or do you deal with the population, or noble causes, or your own values for that matter? Expediency has taken precedent over what you should have been doing normatively. I know whether in politics you can say something you should have. I mean, people do what's good for them. But in any case, I mean, I think there is a distance, there is a gap between values and practice, and certainly the EU is not immune. As a matter of fact, I will close with this comment. The best advice I give to the EU and the West in general is, if you want to do good, just don't do harm. Before you begin to think about doing the right things. In a few cases at least, but that's a discussion for another matter, the action by outsiders vis-a-vis the region have been disastrous. And I can go on and on and on. Take just Iraq as your example. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That is indeed another conversation, but I think one needs to have it. Actually, also about civil society interaction, I think the EU has learned a few lessons and is now talking to civil society representatives. Just last week, there was a huge consultation with civil society, but it's the start of a very long process. Ali, please.
Justement, madame, moi je vais finir.
Well, madam, I would like to say a few words to the European civil society, because I refer to the MENA civil society in my input. Let me be frank. There is always the state interest in the mind of policymakers. You must be frank and honest and say it. And the EU also is influenced itself by the interest of its own member states. In Tunisia, we have currently a problem, namely the free trade agreements. We have a problem with the free trade, the full and deep free trade agreement. And main reservations have been made by civil society about agriculture and services. And I think that the European civil society should support the Tunisian civil society, because in our view, you cannot put on equal footing a tobacco peasant, a tobacco farmer, i.e. from the northwest of Tunisia, with a European farmer who gets European grants. And so the same reservations are true for services. So if we want this Tunisian model to succeed, we need to take this on board. Another aspect that is dear to my heart is that of the refugees. After the revolution, when there was the uprising in Libya, we hosted 2 million Libyans. We are a country of 11 million people, and we have sheltered 2 million Libyans. And nobody talked about that. And they share the milk of our children. And here in Europe, everybody is up in arms. All the medias are making the headlines when you talk about sheltering a few hundred thousands of people, and there was we were even on the verge of having an extreme right president in Austria. So as a Peace Nobel Prize winner, I cannot avoid talking about the situation in Palestine. You cannot talk about a peace in Europe without talking about this injustice. You cannot sort out this problem without finding a fair and sustainable solution for both the Palestinian and Israeli people. And I will end on this.
Well, thank you for a very stimulating discussion. I don't think we've managed to clarify or deal with all the problems, but at least we have a better understanding, I do, about what's happening there, and perhaps a few remedies for the future. So please join me in thanking our panelists.